We are living in the golden age of science, the golden era. We know more about the universe, this planet, and about ourselves than we've ever known before. And yet, we live in a moment of disillusionment, disconnection, distrust that is also not just typical.
Welcome to the Policy Net podcast by the UNESCO Inclusive Policy Lab. This is the place where top figures come to talk data and solutions that reset us along a more equitable and smart path. Today we have a high-level episode hosted by Gabriela Ramos, UNESCO's Assistant Director General for Social and Human Sciences. The guest is Sudip Parikh, the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Executive Publisher of the Science Journals. Together they discuss the biggest challenges faced by the science today and explain how those affect each and every one of us.
We have this increased populism. We saw it with the COVID. We see it with climate change. Sometimes researchers and scientific people being harassed.
If you are a part of a group, a faith, a community, a political party, if there is a social cost to taking in fact that is incompatible with the beliefs of that group, the belonging is more important than the truth right now.
They say communication is key, and leaving an imprint on policy has rarely been so important for science.
Sometimes we feel like we can take refuge in the laboratory and that there's rationality there, but this is not a moment for that. This is a moment to use our outside voices. This is a moment to engage. This is a moment for us to bring our rationality, objectivity, and sense of wonder back to the world.
There is always this question of how do we get the right science combined with the policy decisions that will deliver change.
They also talk about investments and incentives to trigger the kind of change we need.
Right now, there are incentives for active disinformation. You can make millions of dollars by actively disseminating disinformation. And we have got to show that we as a community have a plan. And that plan includes investing in these scientists around the world who are our greatest hope for changing the path of social disillusionment and social upheaval.
To turn the ivory tower that sometimes scientists built for themselves into a real, transparent environment, we also need to recognize that there should be reforms on the ways we produce science.
You're listening to the PolicyNet podcast.
It's great to have you here, Sudip.
Thank you, Gabriela. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate, and I'm excited to be here and looking forward to this discussion.
We will be covering issues of trust in science, the interface of science with the public, and the role of science communication in all of this. This is core to what you have done for so many years. We are in a very complex situation. I guess that we always say that historically. I guess that all of our predecessors have always said that they live in a very complex situation. But it seems that all the crises that we are confronting, all the issues that are putting a lot of pressure in our societies, are also creating this environment in which we also see emerging populism trends, denial of science, the digital transformation. So I want you to start by informing our public, what is your take of the status of science nowadays? And how do you make sense of all these other trends that are not really appreciating what science can contribute?
Gabriela, when I was a kid, I used to think, wouldn't it have been amazing to live during one of the golden ages of science, to live in 1905 and have a chance to speak with Einstein during his dramatic year, to live in the 1600s and get a chance to meet Isaac Newton, or to live through the 60s and to be there when the biologists determined the genetic code and how it worked. But after 4 years in this role of being the executive publisher of science and of being the CEO of AAAS, I realized that we are living in the golden age of science, the golden era. We know more about the universe, this planet, and about ourselves than we've ever known before. We are able to modify the genome to treat and cure disease. Scientists didn't used to talk about cures. We can do that now. We are able to produce enough food for 8 billion people. Now, whether it gets to the people or not is a different story, and we can talk about that. But we were able to produce enough food for 8 billion people. We are able to understand our universe in such amazing ways that we know that we can feel the gravitational waves coming from two black holes crashing into one another 10 billion light years away. So we live in extraordinary times that I wouldn't change for anything. And yet, we live in a moment of disillusionment, disconnection, distrust. That is also not just typical. We have a tendency to say it's always been this way, it's always been this way. But the pace of change, some of it wrought by the technologies and the scientific discoveries that our enterprise has achieved, is driving a sense of loss of control loss of interaction, loss of understanding that I think is new. So we have to be prepared to deal with that because, to paraphrase Carl Sagan, we've built a society that is built on foundations of science and technology and discovery. We couldn't live our lives without those innovations and those technologies that are coming from scientific discovery. And yet, if the greater part of the population does not understand that science, does not feel connected to that science, does not feel the benefits of that science, then that edifice will slowly fall apart. We cannot continue in this golden era if we don't make that connection. And so building these lines of trust, building communication channels that are two-way, not one-way, making sure that scientists are not disconnected from their communities is critical if we're going to continue the era of scientific discovery and mitigate the era of social polarization.
And that brings us to something very prominent, a decline in trust in science. I was really stopped when I saw this survey asking people if they trust in science. And in general, people said yes. But then when they said, do you trust the science that goes into policy decisions? It fell massively. So I think there is this connection between scientific endeavors when it goes into applied science for policy decisions and the link with trust in science and the communication of science. It gets a little bit confused. What would you tell our listeners about these elements? Because we might need to dissect them and understand them better in a context also where we have the climate change and we have the inequalities and we have all of these trends that are also calling massively for more science.
You're right. We have big existential threats and crises upon us. Frankly, the pace of those crises coming at us has increased, whether it's pandemics or it's climate change or it's the food and water insecurity. These are coming at us very quickly. You're right to point out this decrease in trust in science. There's data from Pew here in the United States showing that scientists are among the most trusted professions, but it's decreasing. The trend line is not good, but we shouldn't lose hope because there is trust there. But this dichotomy that you point out, if you talk about science in that is good science creating policy, then suddenly the numbers go down. I think that this is related to this conclusion that I've seen from some of the research on trust. Belonging has become more important than truth. What I mean by that is that if you are a part of a group, whatever struck that is, faith, a community, a political party, that being a member of that group, if there is a social cost to taking in fact that is incompatible with the beliefs of that group, the belonging is more important than the truth right now. I really wish that wasn't so. I want to believe that the world is a rational place and that we can have a discussion and that I can change your mind. In many places you can, but in the big issues that require big sacrifices, big changes in the way that we live, belonging is more important than truth. The way to get around that is to build relationships. I grew up in Hickory, North Carolina, a small town in North Carolina, a very rural community. My parents immigrated to the United States, so I belong to that community. I come from a community of faith that I can have conversations in. But somehow, in becoming scientists, we become disconnected from those communities. I do believe that there's a real need for us to maintain those relationships with where we come from. Because my going into a community where I am not known is less valuable than a scientist who has come from that community. And this is why the need for science from rural communities, from marginalized communities, from the global south, from the global north, we must have inputs and we must have scientists from all of those places if we're going to be able to communicate back and forth. That trust factor is only going to get fixed when we have representatives in the scientific community from all across the wonderful tapestry of humanity that we know exists out there.
It's very interesting what you're hinting at. The belonging to certain groups, the peer pressure that can exist, the fractured societies, it has to do with really who you trust and who you want to believe in. To turn the ivory tower that sometimes scientific institutions, scientific communities, scientists built for themselves into a real transparent environment to exchange with others, I guess we also need to recognize and be honest and think that there should be some also reforms on the ways we produce science. So what do we finance? How do we decide? How do we create the incentives for these connections, not only in terms of the communities and the policy debates, but also in terms of multidisciplinarity, transdisciplinarity that is so difficult to deliver, really, to move away only for one expertise silos, all of these things that we know. What do you think should be the reforms on these science ecosystems and incentives?
You've hit on something. Incentives are incredibly powerful. Regardless of our meaning, our goals, our best intentions, incentives are incredibly powerful. And over time, they can shape global systems. And so when we talk about how do we incentivize scientists so that it's not just about the ivory tower science, but also about the connection to their communities, you have to think about it in terms of incentive. Let me put it in terms of the journal Science. The journal Science is a place where extraordinary science has been published. And 50 years ago, if you had identified and discovered a new element or a new subatomic particle, that would, of course, be published in Science because it is objectively an advance in scientific understanding. But 50 years ago, if you had identified a simple behavioral change that would reduce health disparities between groups of people in the Mississippi Delta, let's say cardiac arrest between white men and black men in the Mississippi Delta of the United States, that might not have been published in Science. Because even though it would have a gigantic health impact to reduce that health disparity, it would not have been seen as gee whiz science. And so that has already changed. By broadening and opening the aperture of what is important in the sciences, today, if a small behavioral change were discovered like that, we would certainly want to publish it in Science. Now, here's the next step of that. A scientist who identifies that subatomic particle today is still going to get tenure at a university. At that same university, if there is a scientist who for 20 years is in their local community identifying toxins and pollution in the river that runs through their community and is tracking that trend line, and not publishing it in Science or other journals, but rather is communicating with their community about what the trend lines are, what can be done to clean the water, what can be done at a local level to make a difference, that might, at the moment, not be incentivized to get you tenure because it doesn't show up in the tenure package. And so we've got to be able to change those incentives to say both of those things are valuable. The subatomic particle is still valuable. The work on quantum mechanics is still valuable. The work on identifying gene therapy and gene editing is still valuable. So is the work of connection to the community. So is the work of communication. It turns out that not all of us are good at every one of those things. Some of us scientists are wonderful at the math and are not wonderful communicators. We have to lean into that and be able to incentivize it. And that means incentivizing it in the traditional structure of academia, in the traditional structure of industry, in the traditional structure of government. I'm an optimist, and I do see the baby steps that are being taken. It's not enough yet, but we're getting started.
You also mentioned the Global South Divide. I never realized that 80% of the scientific outputs recognized are produced in the Global North. And we continue to see that the triadic patterns, those that are recognized in the three main centers of excellence, are 80% Global North, and I will say 60% US. But how would you see that practically, we can make progress on these very long-standing issues that we have been addressing for quite some time?
When it comes to the Global South Divide, one of the things that I think has been proven over and over again, as you look at the economies of the world that have grown, when they've made investments in research, that there has been an outcome from that that allows minds to wander and creativity to flow. When it's done in an open, free environment where it's okay to challenge dogma, that you see scientific discovery, you see investment in that science, and you see economic growth, certainly. And then when it's done well, you also see growth in well-being and in the social health of a country. And you can see that across the United States after World War II, Europe, Japan, China in the last 30 years. Those investments have made a giant difference. And we've seen huge portions of the population come out of poverty, gigantic portions. I mean, if you look at data, and a lot of this is driven by China and India, that you see huge proportions of people that are coming out of extreme poverty. And it's partly because of investments in infrastructure. And it's partly because of investments in scientific discovery. The part that we can make easier is that some of the objective measures of science are not so objective. We like to think that everything is a number or everything can be measured. But some of them are not. And part of it is that this aperture that identifies behavioral change for decreasing health disparities still needs to encompass what's happening in the global South. You see this vibrant research community in Latin America that is growing. You see it working through open science, through mechanisms of open access to publications. You see it in some of the collaborations that are happening between the North and the South. If you think about the Potsdam Conference, where so much of physics was worked out, or you think about the Asilomar Conference, where recombinant DNA discussions were happening, they're very small discussions, very small groups of people coming together. And we have to broaden that conversation while maintaining relationships. And we can do that in the 21st century. Technology allows that in a way that we never could have done in 1978. And so we have to be able to use the technologies that are here and available now to take a global community. And when a scientist at Stanford meets a scientist from Chile and they have a discussion about the science that is out there, science is an incredibly powerful unifying language. When we see great science amongst each other, we know it. And when we see great and creative minds, we know it. And so we've got to be able to use the technologies of the 21st century to build that global community so that then the recognition that wonderful science can happen in countries where the investment has been low so far. And then those governments can see that investment can lead to economic growth, better health, better well-being for their citizens. We can have a virtuous cycle. And that can be incentivized by some of us who sit in these global structures of objective measuring. That's a UNESCO, that's a AAAS, that's with some of the commercial publishers that are out there. We have to be careful about this. When I talk about what AAAS does, we are now a completely open access publisher. But I have to tell you, that's one step. It's not the whole thing. Because yes, now anybody can read a paper, a research paper in the journal Science immediately. My mother is not a scientist. My mother is a very smart woman who is much smarter than me, but she's not a scientist. And when she looks at a paper in Science, she can't read it. And I can't either, right? I'm a biochemist. I can't read the physics papers that are published in Science. And so one step of this is making science available to every scientist in the world. The next step, and the one that is even more important, is situationally appropriate communication. We have to be able to communicate the meaning and the impact and the potential of scientific discovery in language that is not dumbed down, but rather is meant for the audience that it's going to and that is understandable in all the ways that are important, but reduces the jargon. We scientists communicate in jargon because we must. We must be precise. But we have to understand that when we're communicating with policymakers, when we're communicating with individual people, or we're communicating with different groups, we have to lose that jargon, sacrifice a little bit of precision to maintain accuracy, because that is how we build trust. It's how we build the incentive. And it's how my mother, who is not a scientist, becomes a supporter of scientific research and discovery and the value that it brings to people on this planet. We can't live in our bubbles. We can't live in this separation, because when we do, that edifice will fall. It cannot be sustained.
It's inspiring what you are sharing with our listeners. On the one hand, how can you bring the wisdom coming from many more places and not only the kind of scientific endeavors we know that are well-structured and that are qualified? The other thing is the responsibility that we have as a scientific community to communicate and to be understandable. The investments in the Global South are also very, very important. I can see it even in my own country, in Mexico, where R&D investments are not that high. And I think there is a responsibility from the Global South to invest in those items. But there is also a responsibility in the Global North to make more inclusive the way we build the infrastructures. So these are things that are almost like an action plan.
Yeah, Gabrielle, I think the last time we saw each other in person was in Cape Town, South Africa. And the day before we saw each other, I went out to the Square Kilometer Array Observatory, the SKAO, which is being built in South Africa. What's extraordinary to me about that, it is that it is a global collaboration. There are nations from the global north, from the east, from the south, from the west. And what I saw when I went to visit is that this telescope is being built in ancient lands, lands that are protected from radio frequencies because of the geography. We're attempting to build a connection between this global look at the universe. You know, we want to see galaxies with this telescope. We want to understand the formation of the universe. But the connection that's being built with the children of the Northern Cape is actually just as important as the discoveries we're going to make about the center of the galaxy. If we understand that as we're making those investments, if we understand that the investment in the connection between the telescope and the community is just as important as the investment in the sensors that are going to look at the black hole at the center of our galaxy, that's when we will have made a real leap in our thinking. Because if we can make that connection, then I'm convinced that there's a child there in the Northern Cape that will be amongst the group of collaborators that finds a cure for Alzheimer's, that there will be a child who builds the next great telescope and sees farther than anybody's ever seen before. That's why I think that investments that come from the Global North and the Global South that are in collaboration and build infrastructure and build people, because all of this is built on people. The technology is here, but it becomes obsolete in a year. People do not become obsolete if we don't let them. We have to invest in people.
Let me bring you to one additional aspect. When we talk about people, that is the role of scientists. Here at UNESCO, we have a recommendation on science and scientific research. Those that are at the core of all these endeavors are the scientists, the researchers. But we have this increased populism. We saw it with the COVID. We see it with climate change. Sometimes researchers and scientific people being harassed because of their findings. Some authoritarian regimes not wanting to communicate the results of research agendas. How do we bring more scientists into this environment? And how do we make the environment more friendly for scientific endeavor that is open, that is free, and that really delivers better for our societies?
This is a problem that has been ongoing for centuries. And so we should look to some of the work that our organizations have done in the past. The AAAS has been involved in looking at scientific freedom and scientific responsibility for a very long time, decades, going back to the 1960s and 1970s, when scientists in certain parts of the world were not able to enjoy the freedom to think in every direction, to be creative, to collaborate. And we know that when science is constrained in those ways, that we don't reach full potential. So part of what we have to be able to do is, first of all, shine a light. The worst thing that can happen is for scientists to be in danger or threatened and for no one to know, because this creates a culture of secrecy and of intimidation that we cannot allow. So organizations like the AAAS, the National Academy of Sciences and Medicine and Engineering here in the United States, UNESCO, others around the world have been real champions in shining a light and ensuring that we know when scientists are being threatened, when they are in danger, because we want to create that freedom of inquiry that is so important to discovery and progress. We want to also make sure that we have access to the most brilliant minds in the world. I am a firm believer that this ability to go beyond where we are as a general society, to think beyond that in the way that Einstein or Newton or others around the world have done, is everywhere. We just have to be able to find it. And so what that means is we need to be able to create systems and programs and incentives that ensure that we are not just drawing scientists from Cambridge and Palo Alto and London and Paris, but we're also drawing scientists in the United States from the Central Valley of California or the Mississippi Delta or Appalachia, in Europe from Eastern Europe, from parts of India that are still under the weight of poverty. We need to be able to find scientists from everywhere. To be able to do this, we need to show two things. One is that you can have an impact by scientific discovery. I've noticed in this generation that is coming up right now, they are driven by the ability to change the world in their communities. The second is that there is a path. And this is really important because we are right now in the U.S. and in the Global North, in fact, hurting ourselves as well, and also hurting ourselves in the Global South, in that we are not showing that there is a path to success and a good life for yourself as a scientist by pursuing a scientific degree. Our incentives are such that we have turned graduate students and postdocs and researchers at the early career stages into worker bees as opposed to thought partners for senior scientists. And we've got to change that. And I'm going to speak at a science festival for young people. And they are so excited. They want to be excited about science, but they've also got to see that a job in the sciences can help their own community and help their own family. That is something that we have not done well enough. All these pieces, we've got to make sure that that environment as a whole is out there. Yet it's connected to all of society. And this is where I want to go back to the things that you talked about at the very beginning, the pace of change, the social upheaval. Right now, there are incentives for active disinformation. You can make millions of dollars by actively disseminating disinformation. And in that world, as a young scientist, you can feel hopeless. And we have got to show that there is hope, that we as a community have a plan. And that plan includes investing in these scientists around the world who are our greatest hope for changing the path of social disillusionment and social upheaval.
I really believe in getting people more excited about the scientific endeavors. So fundamentally important, I wanted to just close this segment on how to produce more science, bring more scientists, get people to understand the value of science, communicating of science, with the policy link. We have the Inclusive Policy Lab here because there is always this question of how do we get the right science combined with the policy decisions that will deliver change, which is exactly what you are aiming at, science for change. So this question, Sudip, is the question of science policy nexus. Independently of having more populist governments that might neglect science, the intricacies of getting the science of policy decisions right, which is not very straightforward, no?
If only I knew the answers, Gabriela. But there are certain things that I believe deeply. One is that to get good science policy, you have to have an infrastructure of being able to curate, create consensus among scientists. Now, that's not always right. Sometimes we get it wrong, and we have to be humble enough to understand that. And we have to be humble enough to say, this is what the science is telling us today, that we will get more data, and it can change. And we have to be honest about that. But we have to create the right systems so that we can raise up what is that consensus, and what is the counter-argument in case there is a minority scientific opinion. Scientists of goodwill can disagree. We know that. We do it often. In fact, it's one of our strengths. The second piece is that if we're going to have an impact on policy, no matter how eloquent your words as a scientific advisor, if you don't have a relationship with a policymaker, then your wonderful words, your eloquence, your talking points will only go so far. And so we have to be doing both things at the same time. We must create the systems that raise up the scientific consensus and then also provide the counter arguments. That's part of what we do here at the AAAS and at Science. That's part of what UNESCO does as well. The second part is to build those relationships so that when it is time to deliver a message, it's coming from someone who is trusted. And that part is something we're also doing here at AAAS. You know, we embed scientists in Congress in the United States and in the executive branch to be there for 2 years, working for those members of Congress and being partners with them. Because, you know, what a member of Congress needs is to be able to say, look, I trust you that you're not here to hurt me politically, that you are here because you are trying to give me the best advice possible, and I trust you. And so then, even if they don't completely understand the scientific argument or the eloquence of the talking points, or they're hearing multiple inputs about different ideas, some of them economic, some of them financial, other points of view, that they have a trusted relationship that they can go back to and say, when the door closes, yes, that policy decision is the right one because I know that Gabriela is not going to hurt me politically and that she's going to give me the best science that she understands and that she's pulling from a scientific community that has built an infrastructure to provide her with the consensus and the counter. If we can do those two things, then we will be making a lot of progress. We are living in a time when populist governments are on the rise, and we're living in a time when polarization is growing. Sometimes we feel like we can take refuge in the laboratory and that there's rationality there. But this is not a moment for that. This is a moment to use our outside voices. This is a moment to engage. This is a moment for us to bring our rationality, objectivity, and sense of wonder back to the world. Because if we don't, we could be headed toward much darker times.
That's right to the point. It's not only even about bringing the best advice and to create this trust also with the policymakers, but to try to get also more scientific knowledge with the policymakers themselves. I cannot close this discussion without asking the question that is all over the place, which is the impact of artificial intelligence in the scientific endeavors, the scientific understanding, the trust in science. I want to ask you, what is the impact of these amazing tools for scientific endeavors? Because, of course, it can empower massive understanding. And we know that if we didn't have artificial intelligence, we would have never shortened the time, the vaccine discovery during the COVID times. And there might be some acceleration process for many things. But we also know that it threatened to create more inequalities, less inclusion. Demanding skills for really mastering these tools is not like a day-to-day. And therefore, how you see things and what would be your recommendation for those that are listening to get the best out of it?
You know, when I talk about that we're living in a golden era of science and technology, you know, AI is a part of that. We have the ability to scale our own thinking with the support of AI. When I was an undergraduate, you know, the thing I did my undergraduate research on was protein folding. How does the DNA code lead to the structure of a protein? And we looked at it through biochemistry and molecular biology and protein crystallography and simulation. And AI was able to mostly solve this problem in a completely different way. And now we're able to generate what proteins look like just from the genetic code. That's the first problem we solved. My goodness, that's a problem that was on the books for decades, you know, scores of decades. And so here we are at this place where AI could help us determine new materials that we can use, new types of drugs. So the impact of AI on the scientific endeavor is already tremendous. Already. It's changing the way the graduate students and postdocs think about the attacking the problems that they want to solve. And so that is wonderful. That part's terrific. And one of the wonders about it is that it doesn't require living in Palo Alto or Cambridge or London or any other center of scientific research. It requires having access to the cloud tools. Now, that is not a matter of scientific infrastructure and investment. It's a matter of freedom. Freedom to access those tools and the ones that are not bounded by political thinking. So that's one. Second is that these tools, for all of their wonder, they still require the human element to make sure that we are not going off in the wrong path, to make sure that we are being ethical. These tools are not ethical on their own. They require humans to be there. They require humans to reach their full potential. And so here's my thoughts on where this is headed. In the short term, in the scientific endeavor itself, AI is already playing a role, but frankly, it's not as big a role as it will someday in the near future. So it's going to be slow in relative terms, and then it's going to be incredibly fast in terms of the effect that AI has on the scientific endeavor. The impact that AI has on our social understanding, we need social sciences more than ever to help us understand this, because we are running experiments on the global population in real time, and that is the scariest thing I can think of. And so we need social science in this moment more than we've ever needed it to think through what is the human interaction with these new technologies going to be like? What can we do to ensure that the humanity is not lost in the run-up to using these technologies? And what can we do to ensure that nations of the world who have the scientific freedom, the scientific responsibility to pursue these technologies, that they have that space in which to work? That's what a body like UNESCO can do, is to bring that conversation to the table and ensure that these populist governments that are out there, they see that, oh my gosh, if we constrain what our population can do, if we constrain it with political ideology as opposed to scientific creativity and discovery, we will lose out and we will be worse off for it. We can have that conversation at a place like UNESCO. And if we can drive the use of these technologies so that people are better off all around this world, what an extraordinary place this will be in 40 years. I firmly believe that small groups of people are what make the difference. Margaret Mead was a president of the AAAS in the 1970s. She was an anthropologist, and she has a quote that I love. And she says that never underestimate the ability of a small group of committed people to change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And in the face of tremendous change like AI and misinformation, disinformation, and everything else, the only thing that is going to make change and progress for the better is small groups of committed people. And I run across them all around the world, Gabriella, especially when I'm with you.
This is the nicest way of closing this fantastic podcast. In all of the answers is the sense of agency, the sense that we can shape the direction of science. We can change the direction of policy decisions. We can use artificial intelligence for good. And this is exactly what motivates us every day to go on. So I really want to thank you, Sudeep, but for the benefit of our listeners, it would be great if you could just mention some of the resources that are out there, the links, journals, so that they can continue with this conversation through the very good deliverables that the American Association for the Advancement of Science give access to.
Gabriella, I'd be happy to. So first, go to AAAS.org, AAAS.org. That's where you'll find all of our programmatic activities. And so you'll find our work in science diplomacy. You'll find our work in putting scientists into policymaking places for 2 years at a time. You'll also find our helpful toolkits on science communication and other toolkits to help you build your public face as a scientist. I also encourage you to go to science.org. That is where our journals live. We only have 6 journals. We're not a giant publisher, but they are 6 influential journals. They're places of conversation amongst the scientific community that I think are incredibly valuable. The other place I'd suggest for you to go is also to our partner organizations around the world. We are deeply collaborative here at the AAAS. We recognize that we alone are just a small organization trying to make change. And so the websites for the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine in the United States has wonderful resources, both in terms of scientific reports and influential documents, but then also in terms of public-facing websites that are out to help communicate science. So that's one example of one of those partner organizations that I would say you've got to go, and we've got to pull together as a community. We have these abilities. We have these expertises. We've got to bring them together in a coordinated fashion to make our mark.
Our listeners will be sure that thanks to your leadership, they are also understandable. So that's great. I love all what Sudip said, because this is also in the core and the DNA of UNESCO science work. But I also love your call for more social and human sciences, because we need to understand people, we need to understand societies, we need to understand the impact of technologies. And therefore, I finish this conversation feeling somewhat important, but also with a lot of responsibility and things to deliver. Thank you so much, Sudip. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Gabriela. I look forward to our collaboration in the future.
We reached the end of this podcast. For more deep debate and data-driven solutions, follow the PolicyNet podcast on all major platforms.